Hello, this is Richard Arnold Beatty. This week on Useful to God Radio and the Useful Conversations Audiocast, we continue the audio docuseries Culture War, its origins and its effects on humanity. In this episode, professor, scholar, and author Mrs. Nancy Piercy joins me and James Spencer with some definitions and philosophies throughout the years. That's coming up on Useful to God.
Recently, you spoke with author and scholar Professor Nancy Piercy, who is just amazing when you speak to her, about her book. And it really is a culture war against men and masculinity. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so her book, The Toxic War Against Masculinity, it's a great book. I'd recommend it to everybody out there. But one of the things I would say is, yes, it's a war against masculinity, but I'd also say it's a war against femininity. And if we look at the Bible, I would say, particularly, let's say Ephesians 5, 21 and following. Number one, we see that we are to be submitted to one another, right? There's to be a mutual submission. And then Paul's going to go and redefine authority. And that redefinition of authority from something that is domineering and, totalitarian, where the man rules the roost and nobody else really has a voice, is reframed in terms of Christ's humility, in terms of Christ's sacrifice for the church. And then as he redefines that authority, and this is the way that men are to exercise authority, he also then has to give instruction to women. Continue to submit to the men who are no longer domineering and totalitarian. It's now a mutual activity to keep a household. It's not just on the men, as it was in Roman world, where there was a lot more domineering and sort of tyrannical rule going on. It's now a mutual relationship where both the man and the woman choose to exercise their given roles in a different way. And so as we look at the culture war, and as I talked to Nancy about it and through her book, one of the things that I think really came out is that you're seeing in a lot of this just a complete and total misunderstanding of what authority is, how it is to be exercised, and what the sort of hierarchy of relationships is really intended to do. In those texts in Ephesians 5, Paul isn't abolishing a hierarchy. He's not saying that men and women are on the same playing field on everything, or that there isn't a pecking order of some sort. What he's saying is that despite the hierarchy, there is a reciprocity, and that each of you have these different roles. So I think overall, when I look at something like in Ephesians 5, which some people will hear in that conversation, sort of a complementarian perspective, I don't mean to convey that. I don't know that it actually needs to go in that direction. I tend to agree with Nancy on that one. She doesn't argue for a complementarian or egalitarian perspective. But I do think that what we're seeing there is an erosion of and a divisiveness that has come into our culture that is keeping men and women from really working together in harmony. Particularly, I shouldn't say men and women. I should definitely say husbands and wives. And so I think this is how the culture war works, right? There is a redefinition of categories, a redefinition of roles, different expectations are given for what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. And those expectations simply won't fit together. And so what we end up with is difficulty and challenge and tension when there's really supposed to be something that's more akin to harmony. And so overall, I think that's how most of these culture wars tend to work. We divide ourselves in us versus them categories, and then we bite at each other over and over and over again. And the gospel is intended to bring unity. In Christ, we have a different sort of unity. We don't have to war amongst each other, and our peace with one another, our harmony with one another, should be one of our greatest weapons against a culture that can't seem to find peace or harmony, no matter how hard they look for it.
You're listening to Useful to God Radio on KLTT. This is a special audio docuseries on culture war. Recently, Dr. James Spencer spoke with author and scholar Professor Nancy Piercy about the culture war against men and masculinity.
You know, it was largely the hostility that I saw against men, even in respected mainstream publications. Like the particular article that really triggered me was an article in the Washington Post, which was titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" And I thought, really? A Huffington Post editor tweeted hashtag kill all men. You can buy t-shirts that say so many men, so little ammunition. And then there are even books that are coming out very bluntly titled like I Hate Men and No Good Men and The End of Men. And to my surprise, by the way, there were also some male authors jumping on the bandwagon. So there was a male author who wrote a book in which he said, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. And then the final one, which is actually not in the book, but you may have seen it because it was in the news. So the director of the movie Avatar, James Cameron, was quoted in the news saying, do you remember this? Testosterone is a toxin and you have to work it out of your system.
Yeah.
So when I saw that it had become so socially acceptable to attack men this way, I said, we've got to get to the bottom of this. You know, where's this coming from? You can't really stand against a social trend unless you know where it came from and how it developed. And so that was my goal in this book, is to kind of help people get a sense of where is this coming from and how can we stand against it more effectively?
So it isn't just conservative Christians who have declared war on the culture. In many ways, there is a knee-jerk retaliation on the sexes, and the culture has declared war against Christianity. Professor Piercy discusses that in what is called the difference between covenant and contractual theories.
The technical term is social contract theory. Social contract theory was the idea that it was during the early modern era when social philosophers, political philosophers, were trying to find an alternative to Christianity as the basis for modern culture. These were guys who were, you know, out to, you know, get rid of Christianity and form a new basis. Well, you know, up until then, the basis of our social institutions was covenant, not just marriage, but obviously church and even the state. You know, God had established the state, and we obey God by obeying the state. So, and it was God's principles of justice and fairness and right, you know, what's right versus what's wrong, that was the foundation for politics. And so it was a big job to see, can we kick God out of politics? And the early modern thinkers, we're talking about Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau. And what they did is they said, let's just suppose that human society began not in the Garden of Eden, but in a state of nature. And in the state of nature, which was obviously a substitute for the Garden of Eden, humans had no social relationships. There was no marriage. There was no state. There was no civil society. People are running around under the trees as autonomous, disconnected, independent individuals. And then the state is formed when these individuals come together and form a contract, you know, an agreement. So there's nothing organically connecting people. It's all choice. Here's how one political philosopher puts it. Liberalism at the heart is a claim that we can have no obligations to which we have not consented. So consent makes it everything. Now, on the one hand, that doesn't seem so bad in politics, consent of the governed. But the attitude of contract then permeated all of our social institutions so that, you know, marriage is now treated mostly as a contract. What's the difference? You know, a covenant is where two people, you know, unite their lives. A contract is where an exchange of goods and services, you know, and it lasts only as long as it's benefiting me. And so a lot of people do treat marriage like, well, as long as I'm happy, but if I'm not, I'm out. And even abortion, our abortion law is based on the notion that the mother is not organically connected to the child, that she has a right to, you know, consent or not consent, right? It's social contract theory. And that's how our laws about abortion are. That's how they're framed. So even something as intimate as, you know, you grow a baby inside of you, if you're a woman, that is not considered an organic relationship. In my book, Love Thy Body, I actually quote some liberal philosophers who say, The fetus is an intruder. It's like my private, this is my private property. And the fetus is an intruder, and I can drive him off if I want, even to the point of killing him. It's a matter of self-defense. So that's how deeply has permeating the American society. And I think even a lot of Christians kind of treat marriage that way as well.
Professor Piercy also discusses that in what is called the difference between, and this comes from really modern day, but kind of at this point, ancient philosophies. We're talking about Hobbes and we're talking about Hume and everybody else, mm-hmm. between covenant and contractual theories. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the distinction she makes, and I think it's a really good one, is that at some point in the past, there was a sense of the common good. So if you can imagine, and this is by no means, I think we have to really be clear about this. This is not Christian worldview stuff, right? Christians are the only people who can hold a Christian worldview. Okay. And so when we're talking about this, what we're talking about is a generalized order that would be more in line with, let's say, a natural or general revelation. We're recognizing patterns within God's world and God's creation that fit together and that seem to result in good for a lot of people, if not all people. And so in a covenantal approach, what is envisioned is that our relationships are sort of governed by a sense of the common good. And everybody is trying to preserve that common good. We're not necessarily trying to short ourselves, but at the same time, if we need to short ourselves so that the common good can be retained, that's easier to do in a covenantal system. Now, on a contractual theory basis, we are making a contract, an agreement with one another. And we're saying that when we make an agreement, I'm trying to get the best I can for me, and I'm trying to maybe get the best I can for you. But really, I'm really just trying to get the best I can for me. I'm trying to get you to agree to things that are good for me. And it isn't that the contractual system is automatically sort of corrupt. It's just that it's easier for me in a contractual relationship to work for my good and to ignore your good. And so Nancy talks about this in the Industrial Revolution, where a lot of this starts to shift, and then the movement of men into the workforce, so that as they move into the workforce and as they're working in industry and they're further away from the home, men, it becomes easier for men not to take responsibility for their family. And so she's got some really amazing work in this book, talking about even things like women's suffrage, and how initially women were against women's suffrage, women's right to vote, because they wanted to make sure that men retained a sense of the common good, that they were answerable and responsible to the family in some way. And by voting for the family, there was a real connection that was retained there. And so overall, what I think is happening here is that the culture has not declared war on Christianity. I think the culture is fundamentally at odds with Christianity. And oftentimes what we end up seeing is that when the culture is fundamentally at odds with Christianity, there are times where we're going to experience that in a more or less, in a way that has less friction. Right. And so we're going to find times and epochs where, the culture and the church are going to get along swimmingly, and we'll kind of stay out of each other's way, and everybody will be comfortable. And then we're going to find times where, the culture is not going to be satisfied with the status quo, and they're going to try to move beyond where they are, and they're going to need to compromise God's order in various different ways to do that. And as that happens, then we come into greater and greater friction with culture. But I would just underscore that the culture is not starting something with us. The culture is fundamentally opposed. It's fundamentally against the church, because it is automatically disordered in that it cannot, cannot have a deep, meaningful relationship with God or demonstrate any loyalty or devotion to him. And without that initial order, there's no way the world can then get the rest of the ordered priorities correct. You know, so what it means to love your neighbor starts to skew because there's no understanding of who God is and there's no allegiance to imitating him, so that that filters down to the rest of our relationships.
So what strikes me in all of that, you make a comment at one point that people's perception of Jesus and his followers and the ideals of masculinity that they exhibit really aren't the sort of masculine characteristics that we normally see in men. You know, it's about harmony and fellowship and community as opposed to aggressiveness and competition, violent acts or what have you. Now we've sort of lost this, what is masculinity? We've got almost a false sense of what masculinity actually is. Is that what people end up identifying as sort of quote unquote toxic?
I would say it's the secular definition of masculinity that has become toxic. Daddy, I start the book with this study because I found that this book is more controversial than any book I've ever written. Because my earlier book, Love Thy Body, was on questions of abortion, homosexuality, transgenderism. Right. People are saying that book is more relevant now than when you wrote it. Even in non-Christian cultures, you know, apparently it's intrinsic, it's innate. It's because men are made in the image of God that they do know what it means to be a good man. It was the first ever cross-cultural study of concepts of masculinity. And he said that despite the differences in cultures, all cultures share a common code for manhood, that the good man will provide, protect, and procreate. He calls it the three P's. Provide, protect, and procreate, meaning become a father, build into the next generation. And so both of these were global studies showing that men do know that their unique masculine strengths, because they do have unique strengths, were given them not to get what they want, but to provide, protect, care for those that they love and are responsible for. But on the other hand, of course, there's this competing script. What the young men responded to as the real man, if it's separated, if it's detached from a moral vision, can become entitlement, dominance, control, you know, the things that we tend to consider more toxic. The Andrew Tate phenomenon, right? Fast cars, fast money, fast girls. That has become kind of the secular script of the quote unquote real man. On the one hand, this gives us a much better way to approach these issues, right? Most men don't respond well to being called toxic. Nobody would. So much better to try to support them, encourage them, affirm them in what they intrinsically and innately know is the good man. And on the other hand, we need to sort of trace the roots of the real man and help people to see through it. And a lot of my book is taken up with, you know, where did the real man come from? How did our society become so secularized that it's led to Andrew Tate? Andrew Tate, I'll just give you one more anecdote. This was a former graduate student of mine who now teaches at a Christian school. And she recently emailed me and said, all my male students are fans of Andrew Tate. You know, they're even using his quotes in the yearbook. And I said, well, where do you teach? At a classical Christian school. So even young Christian men are reaching out to these online influencers. We have to help them to be able to think critically about where the secular script for the quote unquote real man comes from so that they have a critical grid in place and can figure out what's biblical and what's not biblical.
I've kind of watched Andrew Tate from afar. I've watched some of his YouTube stuff and those kind of things. I would say, especially after reading your book, I didn't know too much about him. I think I probably, you know, just moved past him because I didn't get the attraction. What is it that you think? I guess to me, when I hear you talk about, you know, true masculinity, and you have these things like integrity and honor and, you know, duty and caring for the little guy, for whatever reason, I gravitate more toward those than I do to things like aggressiveness, competitiveness, vulgarity, for lack of a better term, promiscuity, maybe, you know, all those things. And like, I realize I've got a unique background, you know, coming out of theological studies. And so maybe that has a bigger influence. But I'm just wondering, why do you think that part of it, the bad side, is so much more compelling than the good side? Or how are they confused?
By the way, to bring you up to date, I didn't get Andrew Tate into my book either. And in hindsight, I wish I'd been more on top of these trends. But now there's a new one who has been hailed in the New York Post as the new Andrew Tate. His name is Myron Gaines, and his tagline is, "I help men transform from simps into pimps." And he argues specifically that the relationship between men and women has always been transactional. And here's a direct quote from his book: "All men are Johns, all women are whores." And he's being hailed as, you know, the next Andrew Tate. So where does this come from? I think it comes as a reaction to the fact that men and boys are falling behind and have been for quite a while. You know, boys are falling behind at all levels of education. Starts in kindergarten. You know, they don't have the same fine motor control that a girl has, and so they can't handle the scissors as well. So they already feel like they're falling behind. And all the way up to high school, you know, girls are doing better in grades in terms of homework and grades, and in terms of extracurricular activities and so on. And then college. Colleges now, on average, are 60% female in their students, 40% male. More women than men go to graduate school and even professional schools like law and medicine. And so there have been a host of books that have come out on why boys are falling behind, with titles like Why Boys Fail, The Trouble with Boys, The War Against Boys. So people have been noticing this. And then when those boys grow up, they're falling behind too. Men are doing worse than they were in the past, and worse relative to women. Men are much more likely than women to be homeless, to be drug addicted, drug or alcohol addicted, to have mental illness, to commit crime. 90% or more of prison inmates are male. Unemployment. It's not showing up in the unemployment statistics because they've stopped looking for work. And so researchers had to dig a little deeper. And they now tell us that male unemployment during the key earning ages is at Great Depression era levels. Great Depression era. I mean, that was shocking when I read that, because we remember what a tragedy that was. And then life expectancy has gone down. You know, women's has stayed the same, but men's has gone down, so that a magazine called The New Scientist had an article in which it said the major demographic factor now for early death is being male. And even in Christian circles, so, you know, I teach at Houston Christian University, and when I told my class I was writing a book on masculinity, a male student shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us." 46% of American men in one study agreed that these days society seems to punish men just for acting like men. And so on the one hand, what you're seeing is men falling behind and doing worse, dropping out of school, you know, this sort of failure to launch syndrome that we've all heard about, you know, young men sitting in their mom's basement playing video games. Yeah. But a reaction to that is the Andrew Tate. Boys are not happy doing that. And so when they see an Andrew Tate saying to them, "Man up, get a job, work out, get buff, get women," you know, that's part of it for him, right? He's had seven. Yeah. I think he's had children with seven different women. And Myron Gaines, the new Andrew Tate, specifically says men are naturally promiscuous. Even if he has a main woman, that woman has to understand that he's going to have a lot of other women on the side, because that's just the male nature. And of course, women cannot have other men on the side, but men can, because that's their nature. When that's tied up with the message of empowerment as well, you know, get out there, make money, get yourself in shape, that becomes very attractive to boys who've been falling behind. Unfortunately, that's why the church really has to think through this issue. And how do we present, you know, a balanced biblical view of masculinity that's, you know, both tough and tender, you know, that's courageous and caring, you know, that covers the whole image of God? How do we support young men in developing that kind of a positive view of masculinity?
Yeah, after I read through your book, I just went out and did an internet search. And the guys that I kept coming across, right, when I searched for like masculinity or, you know, what it means to be a man, those kind of things, I came across Andrew Tate an awful lot, right? Although he did seem a little more fringe than, let's say, the other one that kept popping up for me, which was Jordan Peterson. Now, Jordan Peterson obviously has a more constructive message, right? One that's related at least to responsibility and, I would say, more traditionally oriented values. But I didn't find anything that was frequently coming up, masculinity from a Christian perspective, masculinity in the church, other than, you know, what I would consider to be sort of the bravado sort of folks that are sort of almost like saying man up within the church. Are you aware of any sort of good, strong Christian, like, where do we go for this? You know what I mean? Like, when we're looking at this as a church and we're saying we need to address this, we need to fix this, there's part of it that's understanding the issue. And I think your book helps to do that really, really well. And then there's this whole other side of it that says, you know, we've been blaming the church for feminizing things, which I'm not really sure I understand fully. You know, I don't know that I've ever been to a feminine church. You know, like, what does the church do here? What, because it feels to me like a really tricky spot to be in, even after you understand the issue. How do we help men in the church to develop that self-confidence, maybe that tough and tender that you're talking about? What does that even look like outside of sort of basic discipleship?
Yeah. Well, actually, you're right. Basic discipleship. But yeah. there are some decent sort of devotional books for men out there. You might want to tap into Church for Men. There's a website called Church for Men. It's written by a man who wrote a book with a title, Why Men Hate Going to Church. It's very good. It's not a very, it doesn't dig deeply into history or anything like that, but it does give sort of ways in which the church can signal that they're pro-masculinity. And I actually like the site very much. I like his book, Why Men Hate Going to Church. So that's a very practical thing.
Yeah.
But on the level of teaching, one of the most interesting sources I found was a non-Christian historian who talked about how a culture's view of God determines its view of masculinity. And this might help us think it through. For example, he says polytheistic cultures, like, you know, the Norse gods and the Greek gods.
Sure.
The gods are constantly fighting. they're constantly warring. And so they exalt the warrior virtues. So to be a man is to be a warrior. And there's some truth to that. And then this historian goes on to monotheistic religions. And some forms of monotheism, God is so transcendent that he has no relationship with people. And he gives the example of Islam. And I quote a book on Islam that literally says, Allah would not condescend to have a love relationship with mere mortals. The very idea is repugnant. So that's the view of God in Islam. And so that leads to a view of masculinity as, you know, power and authority. Then he moves to Judaism and says, well, that's monotheistic, but God does have a relationship with people, right?
Yeah.
And Jeremiah, God says, you know, I will give them a heart to know me. So God has a covenant relationship with his people. And so in Judaism, to be a man is to be a loving father. Now, you still have the authority, but it's the love and relationship. And then it was so funny reading this secular historian because he says, and then Jesus comes along and he complexifies everything. Because Jesus has all of the good parts, you know, of these other religions, but he introduces something new. You know, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve.
That's professor and author Nancy Piercy on A Part of the Struggle Between the Culture and Masculinity. Some great information. And every time I want to move along on this talk, Ms. Piercy brings out another aspect like servant leadership and the Jesus model for masculinity and mankind. That's coming up next week on Useful to God Radio and Useful Conversations. Thanks for being with us today. My name is Richard Arnold Beatty with Useful to God Radio and our audio docuseries, Culture War, The Origins, History, and Its Effect on Humanity. For more, go to usefultogod.com.